Welcome to the second series of the Reworked podcast, brought to you by diversity consultancy EW Group. I'm Rachel Wilson, and every fortnight I'll be speaking to CEOs, HR leaders, and workplace activists about the steps they are taking to reform and rework organisational culture. I'm at the Shard in London today, where I'm meeting speaker, writer, and activist Salma El-Wadani. Salma's 2017 TEDx talk, Bikinis and Burkas, has had over 14,000 views. As a half-Irish, half-Egyptian Muslim woman, I know she has lots to say on identity and culture, both in the workplace and in wider society. Salma El-Wadani, thank you so much for coming to the Reworked podcast for a chat.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
We're actually in the Shard, are we not?
I know, we're so fancy.
We're very fancy
I felt
today.
Very fancy walking in.
Kind of in matching outfits, which is good.
Lovely.
Which doesn't really translate on a podcast. But we've
check
been
out
here,
the pictures.
Yes. So we've been here running an event for EW Group, which you just kindly really spoke to my audience at. And I've got loads of questions coming out of the things that you were saying. But maybe if we can just start with kind of a general question which I'm interested in. I'm always interested in this question of people who work or to some degree in the diversity and inclusion field, which I know isn't all that you do, but as a woman of colour, you've obviously, and you've told us a little bit this morning about some of your experiences in the workplace and in life generally, which of course you've had not always pleasant experiences.
Rarely pleasant experiences.
So, and having been through the work, been in corporate roles and experienced things at work, how does it feel to have made the transition almost to being now the person who stands up in front of people and talks about diversity and inclusion and kind of offers advice? And
right.
That's a transition, isn't it?
It is. It's a big transition. It oddly feels like the right one, though. It feels like the right way to go, and I've always been so engaged in the conversations about equality, and my mother is an ardent feminist, and I was home educated, so I had a very refined feminist focus education.
Excellent.
That wasn't the norm, I would say. So I've always been really, really engaged in these issues of equality. So to then be able to be on the other side and hopefully inspire or encourage discussion or encourage different things to happen so that people can perhaps hear me and then go back to their own organisations and do some things differently is really lovely, because I actually remember feeling so frustrated when I worked in corporate that things weren't happening or that everything felt like it was against me, and that even the channels that you're supposed to go to, like when something happens, you should go to HR and then they will take the appropriate procedures and then something good will happen because that's what we've been taught and that's what we're told. But that doesn't always play out like that, especially when you're working in a sales company. And if said individual is bringing in enough money, it doesn't always translate to reprimand or repercussions for that individual, because there's so many different things at play.
Sure. So, and those experiences can make you, obviously, naturally, cross. Angry.
Furious. I've been angry for years.
I mean, obviously, I don't get that from you when you're talking in front of audiences, that you don't... I think it is important, isn't it, not to... You know, to do something with the anger that's constructive and not just making people feel like they've been told off or it's a personal attack, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think anger is a really useful tool, and when used in the right way, it's great, and it can be used. And as women, we're generally taught that we're not supposed to be angry and always just smile and keep it under wraps. So there is something very powerful about an angry woman, actually. And I think if you're angry, then you have a right to be, and let that righteous anger out.
Yeah.
But then again, there are times for delicate conversations, and there are times when you have to think about the impact that your words are going to have on an individual. And you may be responsible. You may be the single point that is responsible for that individual becoming really actively engaged in the diversity conversation, or then becoming the complete opposite and fighting against it. That is a choice that's up to you at that specific time. And it's really easy to get overtaken with your emotions and be annoyed and be like, well, you should know this, and I shouldn't be treated like this. But actually, how do I bring you in and nurture you? Because this is all just a huge nurturing education piece, right? Mm-hmm. I remember I had an incident with there's a group of my friends, and we're all people of colour, apart from one of the guys in our group, who's a white male. And there was an incident where he just did something, he stepped out of line. And I really wanted to be like, well, well, he can just get lost, and who cares? He should know better. He's surrounded by us every day. He knows the issues that we face, and et cetera, et cetera. And I remember saying to the other girls in the group, this is actually our opportunity. This is an opportunity. If we're always talking about diversity, we can't just give it lip service either. We need to practice it. And for us, that means doing this really difficult work and rolling up our sleeves and letting our anger simmer down and having a constructive conversation instead of alienating that person. Mm. It's a balance. It's hard.
Yeah, yeah. So as a homeschooled young woman, schooled by this fantastic feminist woman, mother, we love the sound of, obviously. When you then kind of left your homeschool education into wherever you went next, the injustices of the world must have become very, very obvious to you very quickly, did they? Was it?
Do you know what? When the injustices of the world became apparent to me was when I entered corporate.
Okay.
That's when it really became apparent. So I was home educated, did my GCSEs at home, and then went into sixth form for the final 2 years for A-levels before university. Mm-hmm. And I did that in Newcastle. And then I went to university in Newcastle. Mm. And so, yes, we were kind of had things hurled at us in the street, and you had a lot of attacks. And I was still fully veiled then. All through university, I wore a hijab, I wore a headscarf. So I was very visibly and noticeably Muslim and noticeably different. But I was never... And yes, you deal with racist comments in the street, but for the most part, a lot of my friends at the time were white people, because that's what the demographic in Newcastle mostly is. So it just naturally fell that way. Mm. And they never questioned me. And when you're growing up from a young age with those people, from sixth form, when you're 16, 17, it's almost like you're less engaged with those conversations because you haven't had to confront them in the same way. But it wasn't until I entered the corporate world that I was suddenly confronted with my gender and my ethnicity in a way that I never had been before. Suddenly it was a problem, and suddenly it was obvious that I was so different. And you've got different things happening that are making it more obvious. So suddenly you're being paid less than men, and you're being paid less than the white women in your team. Mm. You know, and I knew that from one of my colleagues that I was working with, and suddenly people are asking you really strange questions about why don't you drink, and what does, you know, ISIS or the Taliban want, and can you explain everything to me? You're just suddenly confronted with it in a way that you never have been before. Mm. And so I that's when it really slapped me in the face. Mm. For the most part, I was happy as Larry, trotting along. Like, yeah, racist things happen, but whatever. You just thought they're stupid people. But then you enter corporate, and you're around your peers and the educated elite, for the most part.
Yeah.
And so there's part of you that's like, oh, but I thought you would have known better, but you don't. Mm. And that's quite a hard reconciliation.
Mm. Have you been in any workplace cultures that have been particularly got this right or been better than others in any particular way?
No. They don't spring to mind at all. I can't say, you know, I work for this business and it was incredible. After I finished working in the city, I then, in a kind of a global PLC, I then went to work at a startup. It was a startup for James Khan, who's one of the dragons from Dragon's Den.
Yeah.
Who's Asian.
Of course.
You think, oh, well, it'll be a little bit different.
Yeah.
And yes, it's different in that there might be one or two extra people of colour in that environment. But for the most part, you know, the person I directly reported into, my MD, my CEO, they were all still white people of privilege. Mm-hmm. And so you're still actually battling exactly the same issues.
So you didn't find the culture all that different?
Not at all. And also, you have to remember that not every person of colour wants to take this fight on.
No.
And they're not engaged in the issues and they're happy to leave it. And if I was to have a conversation with some of them when I worked in the startup, they would be like, nope, no problem for me. And they were all male people of colour. And there's lots of the Asian patriarchy going on there that's difficult to navigate.
Right.
But yeah, you can't assume that everyone is as fired up about it as you are.
And have you met some champions along the way?
Yes, I have met champions along the way, which is lovely. And met lots of women who are actively trying to change the conversation and change what's happening. But at the same time, if you're a white woman in those spaces, you can get so engaged in your fight for feminism that you forget about people of colour, or you forget to pass the mic over to a black woman or to create spaces for other women to talk. And I don't think especially in corporate, women are very good at doing that.
Mm.
Or, you know, if you've got a seat at the table, pull up another seat next to you and bring another woman with you, or bring a person of colour with you. Don't just sit at that table. And the reason I'm always giving work to people of colour is because I'm trying to bring everyone up together with me. I'm not trying to be the only representative out here. I need everyone.
That's a lonely
else.
Place.
It's such a lonely place. I would say that we rise as one. Nothing exists in isolation. Mm. It takes a village, and we will rise up together, and we need to.
Mm-hmm. Can we go back a little bit, if you don't mind me asking you, a little bit about your journey in a Muslim sense? Mm. So you mentioned that you wore the veil during your time at university at Newcastle. Mm. You've published some fantastic TED Talks on this subject. So can you talk to me a little bit about that transition for you?
So yes, I wore a headscarf for 6 years. My mother still wears it. My family are really religious. I'm a very religious person, but it manifests in different ways. So my parents, we all practice it in different ways, but believe the same tenets. So I wore a headscarf all through university from about the age of 16 onwards. And it was funny because I remember when I was at university, I was still wearing a headscarf, but still whipping it off to go clubbing at night time, or still sometimes being like, oh, I don't want to wear it, so when I get around the corner of my house, I'll take it off and go out with my friends, and then I'll put it on before I come home. It was getting to that stage. And you're naturally exploring and pushing boundaries and figuring out who you are as a young woman. And you have to do it with religion on top of you, and as well, you have to do it in a post 9/11 world.
Yeah.
And life visibly shifted for me after 9/11. It was a real tangible thing. Things got harder. Life got much harder for us. We got more abuse in the street. We got more ridiculous questions. It was harder to get jobs. It just did get harder, and that's my reality.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to battle out your womanhood and grow into yourself whilst also kind of carrying this mantle of being a Muslim and having to answer for everyone else at the same time. That's a tricky place to go through adolescence or to go through those things. And so I was probably really rebelling against that, hating having to carry all of the Muslim community every time I stepped outside my house. And at the time, actually, my boyfriend at the time was a white Yorkshire guy who wasn't Muslim at all. And that was really difficult because you're then with a white man who's not Muslim, but you're Muslim and you're wearing a headscarf, but you don't want to sometimes, but sometimes you do want to. And I kept my headscarf on because for me it was kind of my last tie in a time when I was pulling away or rebelling, and I knew I didn't want to lose it completely. So I was like, this is the thing that is going to link me to my faith, and I need to hold on to this. And then after university, I graduated and then I did my master's. And once I graduated from that, I went to live in Cairo. So I was in Egypt for 2 years living there during the revolution, fought in the revolution for a bit, which was great.
Wow.
And then when I was in Cairo, that was when I took my headscarf off, which is strange to move to a Muslim country and then decide.
Yeah.
But I just got more in touch with my faith. It was easier to be Muslim. Every time I stood up to say, I'm going to go pray in the middle of the day, you know, not every head in the room looked at me like, why? Or there weren't stupid questions like, why are you kissing the floor? You know, people understood how you prayed and you didn't have to explain it or justify it. So it was an easy place. So faith blossomed in a different way. And when the whole world around you is making it hard for you to practice your faith, it becomes hard to practice your faith.
Yeah.
And when you're in an environment where you hear the call to prayer across the country 5 times a day, and if you stand up and say, I'm going to pray, everyone just nods or goes, oh yeah, I need to come with you as well. And if you're wearing a headscarf, no one's looking at you different. It's a beautiful space to then explore your religion. And I did that. And I never felt that I had to wear a headscarf, kind of from a theological perspective. And at that point, I felt strong enough and wonderful enough in my relationship with my faith that I could take it off and still have all of my faith with me. And that's how I've been ever since. You know, there are still things that I don't do that are hard lines for me. Like I don't drink, I don't eat pork. But for me, not wearing a headscarf wasn't a thing that I felt was bad, and it was something that I could do. And I always say faith is a very personal thing. Like my relationship with God is so personal, and it's hard to have a personal relationship with God when you're part of a religion that asks you to justify it every single day, or every headline calls for your genocide or calls for you to be othered. So it is difficult. And the difficult questions you get asked are tricky. Mm. And it's tricky within our own communities as well, because, you know, I was with a man that wasn't Muslim and eventually ended up breaking up with him because of that fact. When I loved him very much and he loved me very much, and that wasn't necessarily a reason we should have broken up, but our own community didn't make space for that change either. You know, we're all not making space for each other on both sides of the equation. And I think it leads to really dangerous ground.
It's all these very subtle ways in which power dynamics play out, isn't it? And kind of in groups, you can be in a majority group, or you can be in one group, but then you're wearing another hat where you're, you're in a mixed race relationship, and that's something else.
Exactly. Like, everyone's looking for the label. Yeah. We're also busy trying to stamp a label. So what are you? Are you a good Muslim, or are you one that drinks and goes out partying? Mm-hmm. Or are you someone in a mixed race relationship? Or what are you? People just want to know what you are, mainly for their own understanding and ease, so they know how to address you, I guess. But actually, it all starts to blur when I'm the person who doesn't drink but goes out clubbing every night. Then, and all the person that has sex before marriage, then all the lines are, but still goes to mosque every Friday and prays has a wonderful relationship with God. Everything becomes really blurry when we try to stick a label on it. There's no room for multifaceted people.
Absolutely. But what an interesting journey though to go on. And I'm sure everybody, if they tried to, would be able to think about ways that themselves where they'd struggled with. It's an authenticity question for you. If you're, you know, wearing the headscarf 1 minute and then whipping around the corner and taking it off. And I suppose as a young woman, that's just part of your evolution into an adult, isn't it? Who do I want to be, and
how's that going to play out? And generally, when you're figuring out who you want to be, you're not doing it in such a public way where people are asking you to define it or noticing your every little move. So I remember people used to say, well, why don't you just not wear your headscarf today? Because sometimes you don't wear it. And I would be really offended. I'd be like, well, I want to wear it today. This is my choice. It needs to be for me to whip it on and off. It's not for you to tell me don't wear it at this event. Mm. And that's what it comes back to, doesn't it? Choice. It always kind of comes back to and that's what the whole diversity and inclusion piece is about, giving people the freedom to actively play out their choices that are different from you.
Totally. Right? So, yeah, absolutely. So, you entered the corporate world.
Yeah. That was a shock.
No headscarf. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that potentially the socialising and the alcohol might have replaced that as the big issue in some workplaces that you've been in.
I think it definitely did, because
in London corporate culture, that's obviously how a lot of business gets done in the pub. So.
I'm pretty sure everyone's a functioning alcoholic in this city, honestly. Yes, because when I step out, I'm not visibly Muslim in that way. And I have a very boring conventional beauty. Do you know what I mean? I fill a conventional beauty standard quite easily. And so people are like, okay, we can take you. We can cope with you. Something my mother always, she's always like, tells me I'm betraying the feminist movement with my heels and my eyelashes and whatnot. But I'm packaged well enough for them to understand that.
Yeah.
But they still... They still know that I'm of colour and that I'm not white like them. And then obviously you've got an ethnic name and that they have to stumble over. And then, you're in on a Thursday night, everyone goes to the bar or whatever for drinks, or you're out with client meetings having drinks and everyone's like, oh, I'll just get you, shall I get you this? And you kind of have to say, I'll take a cranberry juice or I'll take a Coke. And what I have found more than anything is that you not drinking alcohol makes everyone else far more uncomfortable than it does you. Yeah. I am never bothered. But the way people are triggered by the fact that I don't drink, they're like, well, why? But don't you just want to try it? Have you never tried it? Mm. I'm like, nope, but I've never tasted alcohol. But they're like, but that's so strange. Well, why don't you just try it? And you find that it triggers their own insecurities about existing in spaces in which they feel they need alcohol. Because I can exist in exactly the same space as you and I am so comfortable. You are not. You need that pint to be in this environment. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes you so uncomfortable about it. But yeah, it was... The Muslim thing was thrown in my face a lot when it came to alcohol or came to eating and I wasn't eating pork, or people just find out about you and they ask you, you know, ridiculous questions, like I mentioned previously, or, you know, and because people generally in corporate, they talk about your love life. They're always like, oh, so how's your love life? What's going on? Did you go on any dates? Or they'll say things like, are you allowed to date? Like, what will happen if you go on a date? I'll burst into flames. I don't know. But yeah, they get very curious about your life in a way that they don't to, like, white people. And that's tricky. I kind of want to say, are you going to go and ask your mate the same question? Like, are they allowed to date? You don't know. They might be come from a really strict family where their father said, you're not going to date until you're 25. Have you tried? Have you asked? No.
Yeah. So you're, you've got your own business.
Yes.
Marketing
consultancy. So I do everything on the marketing spectrum, from content marketing to digital strategies to campaign strategies, whatever it is. Sweet spot is content, just because I'm a writer and I just love to write
Excellent.
Things.
So how, in terms of that period of your life, setting up your own company, you know, that's challenging for everybody, but were there any learning points along the way in terms of how easy or not that is to do as a woman of colour, putting yourself, that requires a lot of putting yourself out there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does require a lot. And there's learnings every day when you're setting up your own business, especially when you're doing it as a marginalised person. And I actually set up my business in a time when my life had kind of gone up in flames and everything had gone terribly wrong. I don't know why I thought that was the time to start a business, but it kind of happened by accident. And it is harder because suddenly when you have your own business, you then have to go out and business develop. So you're not even just in a safe environment where the business is going to come to you. You have to put yourself out there to be like, this is why you should trust me. And what I find the most is that people push back the most on costings. And I talk to men that I know who own businesses, but they don't get the same at all. Mm. They never get the pushback on fees. But by proxy, being a woman and being a woman of colour, your value is just inherently less in this society. And they have that unconscious bias. So they're always like, well, can you just do a different price? No, that's just the price. You can go somewhere else.
Mm.
And a lot of the time it's offensive when they've come to you and then they've been like, can you?
Mm.
Or they've heard about you and they've got this recommendation, but can you do a different price? I think stop pushing me on every little thing, because it's hard enough to create a business on your own as a woman of colour, let alone with you fighting me on every little thing. But it does happen. You get pushback in more ways than I think my white friends who own businesses do get. And that's hard. And it's learning when to push back on that and when to give a little leeway. It's a hard thing to know.
So your other things that you do...
Mm.
You're podcasting as well, aren't you? And
am I podcasting? No, I don't have my own podcast. Although I've been told that I should do one, but I feel like there's just so many great podcasts out there. I do have a radio show.
Oh, that's right.
BBC Radio London. Yeah, so I have a radio show every Friday night, which is all about shining a spotlight on underrepresented talent in the creative communities. So we are always talking to women and people of colour, and even kind of white people from working class backgrounds, because they don't get a voice.
Mm-hmm.
White middle class, white upper class people get a voice, but actually is anyone talking to people who've been on benefits their whole life or are just trying to be singers or artists or creatives? So that's what the show's about, is very much to highlight the diverse talent that we have in London.
Fantastic. For BBC?
BBC Radio London.
Radio London.
Yes.
Do you have any sense of what the demographics are for that show?
So we just started at the end of November, so it's really early days to get the demographics in. So we have to wait for, I think it has to be like 4 or 5 months before they start to get accurate readings. But the whole initiative is to kind of change the demographic of the BBC from being that white, middle-aged, middle-class male that is the BBC. Like, I still walk into the BBC every Friday and just go, wow. And even I'm still affronted or taken back by how many white men there are. There's just so many. And they're all, they've been there like 25 years, 30, and they're legacy men. And they are all older and come from, I don't know, you can talk to them and they've all gone to Oxbridge or something. And so that's why they've perhaps got into the BBC in the first place, because they could afford to do internships or were unpaid. Or, I mean, I grew up in Newcastle and my dad sells socks, he's a market trader, and my mum looked after us. So I spent my childhood very happily, so happily, but we got our clothes from Oxfam, because that's the only place we could afford them. Or my mum would make me, like, I remember my mum making me some clothes because it was easier and she could sew very well, and she'd just get a pattern was cheaper and getting the material than trying to keep up with all the fashions and the trends and the expense. And so that was my reality. So there was no, and I've worked ever since I could work. So there was going to be no way that, you know, all I've ever wanted to do is be a writer. But actually what I have done is take jobs that allowed me to write in whatever capacity. And that's perhaps how I've, after years of, you know, doing the 14-hour days in corporate and selling my soul to the man, that's how I'm able to even be in a position where I can sometimes write and get paid for it. You know, if I'd, if I'd been able to do an internship at a publishing house that was unpaid in London, and I had a home in London or parents that could support me, it would be different.
That all rings so true for me as well. I wanted to get into the creative industries, but it wasn't through coming to London and doing work experience, because you just couldn't
afford it
unless you have somebody who can put you up here. How are you going to
even if for the travel, if you've got
it's a big problem for that. It's the big problem, probably, in terms of bringing diversity into that.
Creative industries.
So I imagine that's a big topic on your radio show then.
Yes, we're always talking about how creatives can balance kind of paying the rent, but also, you know, fulfilling their soul and their creativity and their art. Because we actually only really celebrate the people that have made it, that are part of the 0.5% who earn extortionate amounts, and we give them celebrity status. And, you know, but that's not the story for everyone, and it's not going to be everyone's reality. We have to find a way to work in the creative industries and not be a Kardashian with loads of money, but not be a struggling artist looking to make ways meet. And I know so many writers and poets who would literally tell me they had like £5 for a week. Because they're, and it's wonderful that they're that dedicated to their art, but at the same time, you shouldn't have to live like that.
No, absolutely not.
And even I know there's lots of initiatives in publishing, which is amazing, and it's great. And there's actually a book coming out in February by Pam McMillan and Picador publishing this book, and it's called It's Not About the Burqa, and it's a collection of essays from Muslim women about their experiences. And I've written an essay in there. And but even when I go to the events, or I talk to my editor, or I'm in those publishing spaces, I just look around and it's just white people.
Yeah.
And I think it's 2019 now. How are we still here?
I know. I mean, the interesting thing, I suppose, one of the interesting things about that industry is that it is in the middle of a revolution.
Mm.
People, in a sense that they didn't have when I was trying to get into journalism.
Yeah.
People can have a platform. They can find a platform online.
Yeah,
you know, there's more. It's become slightly more democratised.
Yes,
maybe I'd like to think, but
yeah, I think it has. And when you look at social media platforms, actually, all they are is a self-publishing platform.
Yeah.
So I've built so much of my brand just through Instagram, because I just started publishing poetry on Instagram because I thought, well, I just want to publish it, and then you become known for that thing, and then people start approaching you. So yes, it's wonderful that we have these tools, and it's wonderful that organisations and industries are revolutionising themselves and putting in initiatives for BAME writers or creatives or journalists or whatever it is. But it's also still at a very tricky stage. I think, like I said in my talk, we can get lured into this false sense of security that actually we're going to be okay. So I remember doing a last year in Penguin Random House had a BAME initiative that I kind of got halfway through. And it turns out that all the books they published from that scheme were from, like, white gay men.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, I appreciate that you are still marginalised in that you belong to the LGBTQ community. You are still a white male.
Mm.
Your privilege far supersedes me and my black friends sitting here trying to get publishing deals and tell our story. And it's almost as if what's more palatable for the general public? Mm. So now being gay is becoming quite palatable, and we do big things around Pride every year, and organisations are really backing it and making it visible. We have lots of visible activists in that space. Okay, so now that's become more palatable. So and then now it's like, well, we have to wait until we become more palatable and we can be stomached almost. Mm. We're not quite there yet.
Well, I could keep talking to you, but we are running out of time. I'm sorry. My final question should probably be, what next for you, Salma? What's on the cards this year? What do you want to achieve?
So, first and foremost is publishing.
As an activist, I know you've got plans.
As an activist, I've got big plans. but this year is dedicated to publishing my novel.
Wow.
So I've got a novel all about young Muslim girls growing up that is really important to me, and is really important to get that narrative out there. So the aim is to publish the novel and then get it turned into like a Netflix show or HBO show. That's what we're aiming for.
Absolutely. So you should.
Because when I actually did my master's on children's literature.
Mm-hmm.
And for my thesis, I studied the representation of Muslims within young literature. And crossed over into adult literature as well. And actually what we found, The conclusion of this thesis was that there's three groups that we always fall into.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the terrorist, obviously that age-old narrative.
Mm.
You've got the orientalist, who lives in the desert with like 40 camels, and they're the sixth wife of the sultan. Very Aladdin.
Yeah.
And then you've got the western Westerner, who is someone who has been freed from the shackles of an oppressive religion by the West, and the West has freed them, now they see clearly. Mm. And I remember going through this, and I went through literature for 12 months. I researched literature from Australia, America, England, kind of the Western countries, and never once did I see myself or my friends. You know, the girls that I grew up with, where we went to mosque on a Friday and we went there every night in Ramadan and we fasted and we loved it. But then we also went and had sex with our boyfriends and some of them got drunk. And then we would come back to mosque the next day. And both of those different spectrums enriched us and fulfilled us. And we never wanted to let go of either of them. And that's the reality. That's what young people and young Muslims and young people of colour are dealing with. And so the novel is all about showcasing those stories, just as young women falling in love, going through university, just doing those everyday things. And hopefully, because actually Muslims are not represented in entertainment, the arts, literature, media at all. We don't have any representation. And representation is so important to affecting change. Mm. When you think about kind of passing the Gay Marriage Act in America, 5 years ago, no one would have thought to do it. It was unthinkable. Mm. But then we had really popular sitcoms like Modern Family and really popular celebrities like Ellen DeGeneres, where it was really people were visibly gay and it normalized it. But no one's normalized being a young Muslim person at all, because actually we don't exist outside the narrative of terrorism and honor killings. Mm. So with the novel and hopefully the ensuing show, I'm trying to give us a voice so we can normalize us, so we're just the same as everyone else, and I stop getting questions about ISIS. Mm. that's next year. Fingers crossed.
Well, that old adage, you can't be what you can't see, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds like you need to write a children's book as well.
I know, they do say, though, that people who study children's literature make the worst writers of children's literature. I'll give it a crack anyway. Why not?
Well, I'm sure you'll excel at all of that. I can't wait to see all of that come to life. Honestly, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
I hope this episode gave you some ideas that you can replicate in your own organisation. We'd love it if you could leave a review and also subscribe to Reworked so you don't miss our next episode. Diversity and inclusion at work has never been higher up the agenda. The EW Group team includes learning and development specialists, facilitators, researchers and analysts, all with deep expertise in equality, diversity and inclusion. If you think we can help you rework your own culture, please get in touch.